This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you a special one-hour focus on the corporatization of prisons in the United States.
2.5 million prisoners, infinitely long sentences, and billions in profits on the slavery of prison labor.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Prisons in America are a hugely profitable business and a prototype of the future. We have three guests today to talk about prisons in America: Amos Cayley from the Interfaith Prison Coalition, Earl Amon, a former Black Panther who served 35 years in prisons in New Jersey, and journalist Chris Hedges. U.S. prisons currently hold 2.3 million prisoners, or one quarter of the world's prison population. The system is designed to perpetuate itself, make money, and keep prisoners in place. Prison workers are gouged daily. They don't receive benefits, pensions, overtime, vacations, sick days. They can't organize a strike, and they get no Social Security. The largest owner of for-profit prisons is the Corrections Corporation of America. It holds an average of 81,384 people every day. Another one, Aramark Correction Services, provides food to 600 correctional institutions across America. It was acquired for $8.3 billion by investors several years ago, including Goldman Sachs. Hedges asserts that the massive prison industry functions as forced labor camps that have existed in all totalitarian countries. He says it is a grotesque example of capitalism working. Chris, Earl, Amos, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, you had an excellent article on Truthdig. You write a column for Truthdig, and a couple of weeks ago we all read it on the prison system and how it exploits workers and how it really is a prototype of what dystopian future that we may get in this country and what they do with the, I don't know how many millions of people are in prison these days. Talk to us about it, will you?
Well, what we've seen over the last few years is a steady assault, economic assault, against prisoners and their families. This has come about in a couple ways. First of all, most people, and I teach in prisons in New Jersey, but in New Jersey, for instance, your minimum wage is $1.30 a day. That's so 8 hours of work. You're doing prison labor. You work for the state. You're paid $1.30. They pay you for 5 days a week, so that's about $28 a month. I went back and got commissary prices from 1996 and compared them with commissary prices of today. And we're talking about basic essential items that are not provided by the prison. Things like deodorant, stamps, toothpaste. All of this stuff has risen by, in many cases, over 100%. So, for instance, a little thing of strawberry jelly in 1996 was $1.54. It's today $3.21, and that's 108% increase. So wages, as in the society at large, have remained stagnant and in real terms declined. And yet the commissary items by which people depend for, you know, basic items has gone through the roof. Now, added to that has been a steady withdrawal of items that the state used to provide to people when they were incarcerated, including shoes. So the standard footwear is a Reeboks, which cost $45. If you don't have $45, they will sell you, I mean, it's out of Dickens, these sneakers with cardboard soles that the first time you go out in the yard are shredded. And if you don't have any money, the prison system has thoughtfully provided a loan system so you can go into debt peonage. We have seen private corporations take over the phone system. So in order to get credit, let's say you want to put $10 on your credit, and this is what's really killing families as well as prisoners, they'll charge you a surcharge of $3 to $5. You have to deposit this money before you can make the calls. You're paying 15 cents a minute per call. We have seen the removal of other items like, for instance, thermals. They used to give two blankets. Now they give one. And on top of that, they have prohibited. It used to be that you could send up to 50 pounds Was it a year, Earl? Or
50 pounds a month.
50 pounds a month from your family. Well, they ended that so that you have to go to these private companies that run the commissary and run these stores and pay their inflated prices. Your family can no longer support you. They've also privatized the whole system by which you put money on a prisoner's account, J-Pay. Again, charging draconian fees. For instance, if you sent $5, remember, you know, we're talking about very, very poor families that have very limited resources. You want to send $5, they'll slap you with a $3 fee kind of thing. Up to 40% of the amount can be just a surcharge. And the newest system that J-Pay has now provided for the prisoners is that when you are released, it used to be if you had any money in your account, you would get it. And we're talking about very $100 maybe or something like that. So now you don't get the money. You get a J-Pay card that they charge you $5 for, which you can only use at J-Pay approved banks, and they charge you $2 a week just for using the card. Finally, I will add the fees. I think most people don't understand that when you are sentenced, you are given very large fees. So, you know, $10,000. And there, I have a list. There's 22 different fees that they can impose on you, whether it's child support, extradition costs, auto theft penalty, medical. Well, this is within the system, by the way. Yeah, and I forgot. If you go to the doctor now, they charge you in the system, and they charge you for medication. And if you don't have money or you don't have money to do photocopies of your legal documents, then you start going into debt. You go for medical loans. You go for legal copy loans. You go for legal mail loans. You go for pharmacy loans. You go for commissary loans. And so what we're seeing now is larger and larger numbers of people within the system who are not only broke, I mean, they're not only broken, because most families cannot every month send, they don't have the resources to send money in to those who are incarcerated, because most of the people who are incarcerated are the primary wage earners, were the primary wage earners. People are going into debt. People are broke inside prison, and people are leaving prison. Now, you know, let's say, for instance, you have a $10,000, this is actual case, you have a $10,000 fine that is imposed upon you when you are sentenced. You're earning $28 a month. You have no outside resources. 25 years later, this is an actual case, you still owe $4,000. So people are finishing prison in debt. And when they can't pay that debt, and of course there are no jobs, they're cycled right back into the system. So the very forces of predatory capitalism that are destroying working men and women outside the walls of prison are running rampant inside the walls of prison. And that's why I think we need to look closely, and this is what I did in that article, The Prison State of America, at what's happening to who are most vulnerable, because that is a kind of window into what's going to happen to the rest of us.
Now, compounding this problem of charging for everything is the fact that prisoners who work, who hold jobs mm-hmm. inside correctional facilities, make pennies, if not just a few dollars a month. I thought that a few years ago, prison labor for the private sector was barred by law to avoid unfair competition. What has happened to change that scenario so that inmates are really taken advantage of for their labor?
Well, this is the other issue. And I just want to add one more way they've figured out how to fleece prisoners and their families, which I find absolutely appalling. And that are deathbed visits or going to a 15, you get 15 minutes of viewing. And they charge you for it. So you can be charged up to, in New Jersey, $945.04. And what you're paying for are the guards who are taking you there. Once that fee is slapped on, you can imagine what that does to somebody who's trying to live on $28 a month.
You're with Law and Disorder, and we're talking to Chris Hedges, Earl Ammon, a former prisoner in Black Panther, and Amos Cayley from the Interfaith Prison Coalition. And we're beginning our discussion with The Prison State of America, a powerful article written by Chris Hedges about the prison state of America.
What we've seen now in conjunction, the financial exploitation of the poorest of the poor and the most vulnerable of the vulnerable, is private, for-profit corporations moving into the system and exploiting prison labor. So, for instance, much of the military equipment is produced by federal prisoners. Kevlar jackets, body armor, canteens, I mean, there's a long list. And we have seen innumerable corporations.
Yeah, Chris, give us an idea of which corporations are involved exploiting prison labor.
Well, just about, you know, every large major corporation in the country, a few, Chevron, Bank of America, IBM, Motorola, Microsoft, AT&T, Starbucks, Nintendo, Victoria's Secret, JCPenney, Sears, Walmart, Kmart, Eddie Bauer, Wendy's, Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson, Fruit of the Loom, Motorola, Caterpillar, Sara Lee, Quaker Oats, Mary Kay, Microsoft, Texas Instruments, Dell, Honeywell, Hewlett-Packard, Nortel, Nordstrom's, Revlon, Macy's, Pierre Cardin, and Target.
You know what I get from this? That some of what we may be wearing as we sit at this table with you and using may be made by prison labor.
Very much.
And we say prison labor, really prison slavery.
We have seen prison administrators around the country appeal to corporations that are running sweatshops in places like Bangladesh, saying, come back, because our workers can't organize. Our workers always show up on time. Our workers earn no money. You don't have to pay benefits. Let's not forget that these people are working 8 hours a day inside these institutions for a dollar a day, roughly, you know, if they can get up to $3 a day, but pennies on the dollar, and they are not, they are excluded from Social Security. They will be released with having worked for decades as workers. Because they're in the system, they will not be eligible for Social Security because they never paid into Social Security.
I remember years ago, we used to have this up on our wall, the amendment to the Constitution that says basically involuntary servitude is unconstitutional under the 13th Amendment, but except for basically prison labor.
Right, and that's an important point because it is this form of neo-slavery is legal under the 13th Amendment.
I'd like to bring Earl into the conversation. Earl, you were in prison for 35 years. I think underscoring the point in Chris's article that it's in the interests of the prison industrial complex, which is what's developed, to keep people there. I'd like to ask you, why did you have to serve that much time? You had a good record in prison. You didn't do anything horrible to get in there. And nonetheless, they kept you there and they kept you there and they kept you there. Tell our audience what happened to you.
I think Earl should go right back to the day he's standing in Central Park as a member of the U.S. Army in his uniform. Start there, Earl. And then he awoke.
Okay. Well, in 1967, I was drafted right out of high school into the Army. And my first place I was sent was Fort Polk, Louisiana. And stayed there for about 6 months, I think. And my next posting was Fort Gordon, Georgia. And while at Fort Gordon, Georgia, I met a young white kid from Boston. But prior to that, they had signs up down there that says no niggers, no spicks, and no dogs allowed in restaurants and things of that nature during that time. If you remember that period of time, it was like that in the South.
I do. What year was it?
67.
Wow. So think about that. It's 13 years after Brown v. Board.
Right.
And there's still signs like that everywhere in the
absolutely.
South.
Absolutely. I went to, I was in Fort Gordon, Georgia, and I met this white kid from Boston. And he said, Earl, let's go into town tonight, which is Augusta. He says, let's go into town. There's some bad cats out there. I want you to meet some of these cats and out there. There's some bad cats. I thought he was talking about Motown Temptations. Those are the bad cats I thought he was talking about. I never thought he talked about the Black Panther because I never heard of the Black Panther before. I didn't know him. Went out there and I heard these guys talking about the government. I just couldn't believe that people could stand and talk about the government that way. So I went back a little disturbed by the things I heard. And later on, about a month later, I was transferred back to Fort Dix, New Jersey. Went to Central Park with my sister, and Angela Davis was speaking. I had on my Army uniform at the time, and she said, "Brother, are you in the Army?" I said, "Yes." She said, "You been to the South?" I said, "Yes." She said, "It's really terrible for Black people down there, right?" I said, "Yes, it is." So she said, "You don't need to be in this army. You need to be in our army." You know, like that.
That's great. This is Angela said
yeah.
that?
Yeah, she said, "You need to be in our army." So I said, yeah. Then I heard her talking about, you know, what the government was doing to us and the way we was being treated as human beings. I remember my sister said, "Let's go back. It's time to go back to Jersey. Now it's getting late." I said, "I'm not going back to Jersey. I'm never going back to Jersey. I'm staying right here." I went AWOL that day. Wow. And I didn't go back.
And how old were you then?
I was 19, I think, or 20.
Oh, my.
So I joined the Panthers that day, and I was part of them until about 6 months later, the FBI caught up with me and charged me with being AWOL, sent me to Fort Leavenworth. Not the prison Leavenworth, but Fort Leavenworth, which is the military prison. They sent me there, which is in Kansas. They both is about a mile apart. While there, I stayed there about 9 months, and they released me, and I went back to being a Panther again, you know, came home and had a dishonorable discharge, but I didn't care. You know, all I was concerned about was fighting a corrupt system that had been keeping the feet on my neck all my life. And later on, throughout the next few years, I was involved in something called Operation Breadbasket out of Chicago with Jesse Jackson runs it now. I think it's called something else now. But we was out there to do to feed the poor peoples out there. I was out there when Fred Hampton was killed, and who I already knew personally. And he was around the same age I were at the time when he was killed. I came back to Brooklyn, helped feed some poor peoples in Brooklyn. And doing things like that, I was writing speeches for the party. And I got arrested for guns. And I was sent back to prison again for a few months and came out. Lasted all the way up to the late 70s, and I got arrested for conspiracy to commit bank robbery. Just talking about it. And I was given a life sentence. And they was fighting over who would take me, the feds or the state. So they kept me in limbo for about a year and a half, deciding who's going to take me. They take me to the federal court, send me back to state court. So back and forth. So finally the state got possession of me, and they said, well, we can give him more time than anybody else. So they gave me a life sentence and, yeah, put me in prison.
Conspiracy. We're not talking about a crime being committed. We're just talking about talk.
Yeah,
that
is
a life sentence for talk.
That is a crime. Talk about it. That is a crime. So,
wow, a life sentence from the state.
Yeah, so they gave me a life sentence, and I went to New Jersey State Prison, Trenton. And at the time, they had the whole place was all militant, all revolutionists, black revolutionary army, Black Panthers, Weather Underground, all these different groups in Trenton. It was like exploded with these kind of peoples in Trenton. And I was there, and I was part of it. And me personally, what I wanted to do more than anything else, I wanted to find a way out. I couldn't contribute nothing to anyone's life in there. So I needed to find a way out. So I started doing my paralegal work, and that's how I wound up helping a lot of other people get out of prison. And, you know, I was filing things in court, like reconsideration of sentences. I was filing illegal sentence motions. I was doing divorces for guys. I was doing child support for guys. I was doing fines for guys. I did all those kind of things to help guys get out. And I was real successful at that kind of thing. And after 30 years, I filed a motion for myself to get out of court, an illegal sentence motion. And the judges who saw me, who come back in court, and I came back in court, they couldn't believe that the judge had sentenced me to that much time that many years ago for a robbery. And in fact, one judge told me, said, if I was sentencing you today, I would give you 3 years.
Wow.
He said, I can't believe that they did that to you.
Well, you know,
it's a horrible story.
Yeah.
You know, if you ask me why I think they did it, I think that the beginning of this huge explosion of putting 2.3 million people in prison, including a million black people in America. But the beginning of that wasn't to build the prison industrial complex. That came later. That was kind of took on a life of its own. The beginning of that was a reaction against the civil rights movement and the black power movement. So if you ask me what my guess is or why they did that to you, I would say it was for political reasons.
Yeah, it was. I was the first person in the history of this state to be sentenced to life for a robbery charge. Not only that, when I got released, the day I got released earlier this year, the parole board stated with unmistakable clarity that I had served more time in prison for a robbery than anyone in the history of this state.
Oh,
I didn't shoot anyone. I didn't pistol whip anyone. I didn't even take any money.
And when did you file the petition for yourself to get out?
2012.
Wow. And did you have lawyers along the way at all?
most of it was done pro se, which is meaning I did it on my own. And most of it was done that way. But at times they would give me a public defender when I go into court. But then when the public defender heard my story and what was going on with me and what I was doing, they said, well, why don't you speak for yourself, because you know more about what's going on here than I do. Right. You know, so they gave me an opportunity to speak for myself. And one judge, he was such a gentleman. He just felt so bad for me being in prison all these years, and he couldn't do nothing to get me out. He couldn't overturn what the other judge had done. He couldn't do anything about it. And he just said, I wish I could do something about it. He wrote a letter to the parole board in my behalf, you know. And so when I went back to the parole board, the time I walked in, they said, you don't have to say anything. We're going to release you.
So yeah. How long have you been out now?
Approximately about 8 months.
Wow, very short. Oh, what are you doing? Gosh.
Well, being 65, I can't just get a job doing anything. So I took a job as a construction worker. I'm working about 2 days a week now, just barely enough. You know, and this is one of my work days here that I'm supposed to be at work. That's why I got on my construction outfit, because I went to check into work this morning and left to come to be here. And it's a tough thing for me, a guy 65, to do construction work. Mm-hmm. Jean Ross, who's a friend of mine, was trying to give me some work as a paralegal, but she didn't really need me as a paralegal. She just wanted to try to help my financial situation. And so I said, well, I'm not going to let you do that. So I wouldn't go. She said, I'll pay you $100 a day and expenses, you know, that'll help you out a little bit. So I said, nah, I'm not going to do that. I said, I'd rather wait until I find something that I can really do.
I have so many questions for you. First of all, where did you meet Chris Hedges?
Well,
and I'm also interested in whether you did prison labor, which
yes,
is
I
what
did.
You guys are writing about. So let's talk about both. How you met Chris and
prison labor. I was listening to a pop.
This is People's Organization for Progress.
I was listening to
a great, great organization run by Larry Ham, who's an amazing human being out of Newark.
Right. I was listening to Larry once, and
that was on a radio or something?
No. I was listening to. I went to church one night, and I was.
This is when you were out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was listening to Larry, and he said, next Thursday we're going to have this meeting. We're going to have Chris Hedges. Do you know who Chris Hedges is? I said, no, I don't know who Chris Hedges is.
You didn't know who I was. I didn't.
So we're going to have Chris Hedges there and everything like that. He wrote a number of books and that sort of thing. And so I did. I went there the next day. We had a lot of people there, I think. Jean Ross was there. And I spoke.
Who's Jean Ross?
She's an attorney.
She's a great lawyer in New Jersey. Pretty much dedicated most of her life to helping people incarcerated.
Yeah. And I knew Jean from prison. She knew I was a paralegal while I was in prison, so her and I used to trade things back and forth about the law. Got there, and Chris was there, and everybody got up and spoke, and Larry got me to get up to speak last, I think, to tell him a little bit about myself and who I was. And that's when Chris came over and introduced himself to me, and we met. You know.
And then I was asking you, so you met Chris, and Chris has been writing now,
right?
I mean, from his own experience as well as I presume your own, about what's happening inside the prisons, particularly with labor system. And what were your experiences with the labor system in prison?
Well, the same thing Chris just talked about. For years and years, I've earned $1.30 a day. That's roughly about 20 cents an hour, you know, or less, maybe 15 cents an hour for your labor. And you do all kind of labor. I even have poured concrete and laid bricks in prison, and I still got that.
No Social Security, though.
And you're 65, which is
that's one of the problems. That's one of the problems right now. I'm coming home. I can't get Social Security because I haven't paid nothing into Social Security. And I can't get a job because of my age. So what am I supposed to do?
Did you see a difference in terms of the work opportunities when you were first in prison and now when things have been more privatized? Was there a change in terms of how much you made or how you were treated?
Well, in prison, at one time, there was a rehabilitation program where you could learn a trade, you could do all these kind of things, and you can come out of prison, you know, in a certain amount of time, and you can go back to work, you can get a job as a, let's say, a construction, as a bricklayer, you can get a job as a barber, you can get a job as a pipe fitter, those kind of things, as a carpenter. All these kind of things with trades that were in prison at first, you know, but all of a sudden, all those things just came down, and there was no more of that. You didn't get a trade in anything. If you didn't work, you didn't get no toothpaste. You didn't get no coffee. You didn't get no anything in prison if you didn't work. So you had to work for those $18 a month or you got nothing. Or you didn't have anything because, of course, you've been gone from your family for years. Your family don't even have any money to send you. And if they did, they don't really know you anymore. I got nieces and nephews who are 30 years old I've never met in my life. I'm meeting them now for the first time. They don't know me. They've never met me.
Yeah, it's shocking, the breaking of family ties.
Absolutely. Obviously. Absolutely.
And I just want to throw in there that that's by design.
That's right.
And the way they do it is they run you through a gauntlet at visitation, which is not only meant to be uncomfortable. You can wait outside in the rain or the snow for hours. There's no porta potties. But the children are terrified. And one of the most heartbreaking things about walking into a prison during visitation hours is seeing these small children. Mm-hmm. And the trauma is so extensive to the elderly, to the children, but just to anyone, that you have a large number of people, and Earl can talk to this, who will finally just tell, if they have a really long sentence, they'll just say, don't come anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just think of me as dead.
Absolutely. Yeah. I filed my own divorce because my wife didn't want to end it. So I said, I'll end it for you. You know, because I cannot contribute anything to your life, you know, and so I'm not going to hold you hostage because of my situation. So if you don't want to end this, I will end it. So I filed for divorce, and I did it myself.
And that's by the way, one of the most pernicious aspects of gouging these families and these prisoners on phones, because the only connection that most of these people have with their children is through the phone.
And the reason for that, I think, Chris, is that these prisons are located hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the major urban areas.
Yes.
I just came back. I was visiting a person in the Weather Underground, David Gilbert, and I had to drive 300 miles to get up to see him. And Auburn Correctional Facility, there's a misnomer because they're not correcting anybody. They want to keep them in there, not correct them to send them back. On your point, Chris, in terms of humiliating people, my wife's 69 years old. They put her through the machine that checks for metal, and it goes off, you know. And she wound up having to go into a bathroom where the toilet didn't work, go into a bathroom with a paper bag to take off her bra and put it in the paper bag so she'd get through the machine. And the children, it's heartbreaking. I saw one little two-year-old yell out, Daddy, and run the length of the room to his father. Yeah. It's just, you know, and they keep those people there, isolated from everybody else, hundreds of miles away forever and ever.
Yeah.
You know, it's a nightmare. As a lawyer, I go into prisons often, or did, but even for a lawyer, it's horrible. Horrible. And I have all kinds of privileges, cards, all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what it's like. I can, but it's terrible. And the distances. And when you're talking about prison telephone, it brings up another point that you made in the article. I forgot the word we used to use when we went to some Spanish countries. It's called a boca or a bite. Of every single fee you pay.
It's a kickback.
Right, the kickback. The state or some official or somebody takes a bribe or a bite. And that's what happens on the telephone system.
Well,
which
you pay
for something
else. You have states pulling between commissary, you know, these private commissaries where they're jacking up prices. I mean, I pull an example here of envelopes where a box of envelope white legal size envelopes for 100 costs $7. But you go into a prison, you buy them singly from these private companies for 15 cents, mm-hmm. which is, of course, $15 a box. So you've more than doubled the price. Because they have a captive market, they can overcharge, and the state gets kickbacks. So oftentimes it's up to 40% on JPay, on the phone companies. And we haven't even talked about food service companies, which are Aramark, which are going into these prisons and jails and serving. And there's been all sorts of scandals around the country in terms of rancid food. The prisoners will have to work in the kitchen, but they will put an Aramark employee, a corporate employee, in there, and they weigh everything out, even the garbage, because the whole idea is to make money.
And Aramark is non-union, as I recall,
of
right?
Course, of
and
course.
And Aramark, because I know I see the protests during Occupy at universities, not prisons.
They do
many
food.
Because they were non-union,
yes.
As I recall.
They have different tiers of food plans. So if you go to Skidmore and Aramark runs it, then you get the salad bar and whatever. And then the lowest tier is, of course, prison food.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Law and Disorder, and we're talking to Chris Hedges, Earl Ammon, a former prisoner in Black Panther, and Amos Cayley from the Interfaith Prison Coalition.
Chris, I wanted to mention that the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, the drafter of such laws as Stand Your Ground in Florida, has contributed to some of the harsh laws, the so-called truth in sentencing, mandatory minimum for nonviolent drug offenders, that have really helped the explosion and keeping populations of individuals incarcerated. What hope do we have to reverse this trend?
Well, that's a very important point because, again, this replicates the wider culture, where you have now so many corporations that have a vested interest in perpetuating mass incarceration because they're making a profit off it, including, of course, expanding it. And they have their lobbyists and lobbying groups, such as ALEC, that are, in essence, writing the laws that determine the fate of the poor. And I think that we should be clear that while racism is a gigantic factor in terms of mass incarceration, they've kind of tapped out a lot of the black bodies. And we are seeing the largest increase in the prison population are women and Hispanics, who now make up 35% of the federal system, and poor whites. That this is a beast that will hardly limit itself to color. And those statistics are now being borne out. It is a kind of perfect window into the dystopia that the corporate state would like to create for all of us. This is the kind of perfect world in terms of turning human beings into, you know, little more than serfs, and, you know, it would not be an exaggeration to even use the word slaves. So I don't think that going to state legislatures, and we have bills, for instance, in the New Jersey state legislature, but, you know, they're trapped in committee. Even if they got out on the floor, they won't make it. The corporate forces are now so strong, you know, both on the federal and state level, that I think the only hope left is organization in terms of, you know, people who care or have a conscience, you know, have to begin to organize.
This is a good point, I think, Chris, to bring Amos into the conversation, because Amos, you're the involved in the Interfaith Prison Coalition. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got involved and what you're trying to do.
Well, I went to Princeton Theological Seminary and I went to the Rutgers School of Social Work. In both of those institutions, I'm grateful to, but I also think that the amount of political education that you can access in both of those kinds of professionalization degrees, you have to really look for it and you have to leverage internships. And I did an internship with Bonnie Kerness at the American Friends Service Committee. She runs something called the Prison Watch program, and she has been monitoring prison abuses for about 3 decades plus, and that's actually where I met Earl. So we go back a long way in terms of 5 months, I think. But I've also been doing organizing in the state of New Jersey around solitary confinement, which you probably know this, but in light of the whole burgeoning of the prison industrial complex and where that started in the 70s and 80s, it really did start with political prisoners, in terms of really targeting them for, you know, solitary confinement as a tool of psychological torture. And so I've been working on issues of solitary confinement in New Jersey for a while. But Chris is right, and his last article really, you know, we had been working together for a few weeks, but when I read that article, everything really clicked. It sounded to me...
I want to recommend it again. It's called The Prison State of America, before you continue, sure. Amos. And it is one of the most powerful articles I've read on prisons in the United States. Its first paragraph is stunning, and I recommend it to everyone. But Amos, you're about to talk about it more, so...
I think taking sort of capitalist approach in terms of analysis of what the prison industrial complex does and what function it plays, creating and maintaining a captive workforce. To use sort of a Marxist analogy, you know, the redundant, superfluous population, this whole sort of draconian system that, you know, starts with, maybe doesn't start with, but starts with crumbling schools, school-to-prison pipeline, police surveillance. And Chris is right. You know, it has been a racial issue and it continues to be, but in a lot of ways, I think it's beginning to expand. So to go back to your question, I've been working with churches, faith groups, mosques, synagogues, educational institutions to analyze the signs of our times, seeing what's happening, trying to create a framework from which we can actually see and interpret this stuff. But and I think that the conversation is beginning to reach a fever pitch in terms of talking about the new Jim Crow, trying to connect this to the political struggles of the 60s and 70s and before that, even kind of analyzing the legal way that this has kind of gone in. Naomi Murakawa at Princeton University just released a book called The First Civil Right, and it talks about how, you know, the entrenchment of this as a legal apparatus, it kind of comes before the civil rights movement in a lot of ways.
Entrenchment of, I didn't understand that.
At the end of the 60s, when the Civil Rights Act had already been passed, he said, you know what the first civil right is? The first civil right is the right to be safe in our communities, the right to, and so he flipped the script of what Truman had called the first civil right in terms of blacks being able to be safe in the South from anti-black violence. And so Nixon flips the script and he says, you know, who has the right to be safe is white people from black people. So.
And that was, just to interject, a time when Nixon and others really had television commercials with okay. white women walking down the street, yeah. making them, you know, feel fearful of persons of color.
Right. So this is all coalescing at a time when the plans are being laid for the prison industrial complex. All that to say, the framework, the political framework and the analysis is very key. However, and this is a big however, what we're learning from the Black Lives Matter coalition, you can't even really call it a coalition because it's many coalitions, responding spontaneously to police violence, to the state-imposed terror that's happening both in the prison and outside of the prison on poor families, particularly communities of color. What's happening is we're realizing that talk is cheap. And so looking at what people who are most affected and most affectable are doing in terms of mobilizing themselves around this is really the key to creating a sustained grassroots effort against the system. So what Chris is saying is absolutely right. Legal approaches, diplomatic approaches, legislative approaches, they might have their place in terms of pushing back against the system, and I believe that they do. But if we're really hoping to dismantle what's happening, we really have to organize around the demands of the families and the victims. So that's what the Interfaith Prison Coalition is about. We have been in contact with many prisoners in the New Jersey state prison system who desire to organize around a few issues, and their families are wanting to organize around a few issues. So that's why I'm really excited about this coalition. It's starting from their demands. So in general, we've talked about the conditions of prison. And I'll just say a little thing about solitary confinement and the role that it plays in, I would say it's a union-busting role in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It operates as a threat against dissident prisoners who might organize, who might
They justify it, be of course, disruptive. As gang-busting.
That's right. So there are many different kinds of solitary confinement. Yeah. Some of it is protective custody, and I'm using air quotes there. Yeah. But some of it is disciplinary segregation, administrative segregation. But the way, I would say it's just the way that it functions as an option within the prison. If you don't fall in line within the prison, it operates as the sword that's sort of hanging over the head. You can be put in there really indiscriminately. There are very few rules. So that is an issue that I think the Interfaith Prison Coalition is concerned about, but the main thing that we're talking about today is economics, right? Chris mentioned that prisoners in New Jersey make $1.30 a day. That's not $1.30 an hour. It's $1.30 a day. And many of, you know, if you think about the for-profit companies that Chris mentioned, the overhead there is just, it's ridiculous, right? One of the things that we're looking at doing immediately is mounting a campaign to make it such that prisoners are paid minimum wage, not a new minimum wage, not $3 a day necessarily. We're talking about, you know, the minimum wage for service workers on the outside, which, you know, would make a huge impact. We'll just say it'll have a huge impact.
How are you going about that?
So it's a really brand new coalition, you know, one that we think is going to take some time, and we're going to dedicate the right amount of time and resources to it. Right now, we're in a lot of ways in the planning phase. So we're going to have our first meeting in mid-February. It's not exactly determined, but it'll be in Newark, probably at a house of worship. Interfaith Prison Coalition, we have a website. It's IPCNJ. So the NJ is New Jersey. IPCNJ.org. Facebook.com/Interfaith Prison Coalition.
And Earl, are you going to be involved in this as well?
I don't know. This is extraordinary stuff here. I'm enjoying it. I like everybody around the table here.
Oh, it's wonderful to see you.
Yes. I personally been working with the NAACP in Irvington, you know, great chapter over there, great president over there. And I've been doing some work with them. I've been getting with People's Organization for Progress every chance I get. And anytime I can do something to help the situation out in prison, I am all for that. You know, I got guys there who been there for 30 years already and going to be there for more, you know, and any way I can do anything to help those guys. Some of them guys been in prison since they was 14 years old. Mm. You know, they're friends of mine. So I wouldn't want to be out here doing nothing when I can be doing something to contribute to those guys' lives. You know, I got guys who work in the law library and the Prisoner Legal Association who need, you know, they can do the legal work, but the things they need to do on the outside, they can't do. You know, I can go over to the courthouse and pick up some paperwork that might take them 6 months to get. You know, so little things like that I can do for these guys. So I do everything I can to help these guys out.
People like Earl, in terms of people who have spent time in the prison, people who have the know-how that we don't have, are going to be really crucial to this. The other aspects of mounting this coalition will be not just the families, not just the current prisoners or the former prisoners, but we're really reaching out to labor unions, because this is a labor union issue. We need to really organize on the outside, and faith communities. This is an issue of faith, moral conscience, not just an issue of civil rights, but an issue of human rights and God-given rights.
What do you think of a campaign to create minimum wage for prisoners? Do you think that can work?
I think it can work. I think anything that would help contribute to these guys' lives will work. You know, we have to try everything, because right now these guys have nothing. These guys cannot do anything. These guys cannot even afford to pay a couple hundred dollars to a lawyer to help them out with anything. They don't have anything. And some of these guys work 12 hours a day. As I said, I work as a paralegal, and I used to work in the office that I was in sometimes 15 hours a day. And I got absolutely almost nothing for it, you know. So anything you can get, a few dollars, would have really helped me out. In fact, I'm absolutely sure, had I earned some money while I was in prison, I could have got out of prison much earlier. You got to remember, I wasn't in prison for committing nefarious acts. I didn't kill anyone or rape anyone or sell no extraordinary amount of drugs to anyone. I didn't do those kind of things. And I spent 35 years in prison. Imagine what some of these guys who got, let's say, a murder charge, imagine how much time they're going to spend in prison. So these guys need some help. Some of these guys spent 30 years in prison, and they found out that these guys didn't commit the crime. They've been sitting there for 30 years, and their life is virtually over. Now what do you do about these guys? How do you repay these guys? You know, I got friends, like I said, work right now in the law library, right now in Rahway, who absolutely didn't commit the crimes they was charged with. And they have no way of proving it, or no way of getting any help to do it.
I mean, that's the tragedy. You see, because they're poor and because they're forced to plea out. So Earl and I were speaking about a particular prisoner who everybody is, you know, 100% certain was railroaded. it's usually those people who say, look, I didn't do it. They go into the system, and they have to be punished because it's, what, 94% take pleas. If everybody actually went to court, the whole system would crash.
Absolutely.
And so they punish those who go to the court, who are often the innocent. I don't even like the term innocent. You know, I covered the war in Yugoslavia. Gabriel Princip assassinated the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife Sophie, the heir to the Austrian-Hungarian throne, and got 20 years. I mean, the sentences that we impose and the fact that, as Earl said, all of these, especially in the 70s, these programs at rehabilitation were taken away. And now we have vested corporate interests that want to make sure that those programs never come back, because recidivism is what keeps money coming in. You go on Correction Corp of America website and they talk about why you should invest. This is the largest private prison corporation in the country. You should invest to us because there's 64% recidivism.
Mm-hmm.
As if that's, you know, to assure their stockholders, don't worry. There's an endless supply of human bodies for corporate profit. And the bottom line is that, you know, as we have moved our manufacturing overseas to sweatshops, we have had, you know, surplus human bodies on the streets at first of our inner cities, where there's been no employment. Those bodies of poor black and brown people are worth nothing to the corporate state in Newark or Camden or Jersey City, but they're worth $40,000 or $50,000 a year when we lock them in cages. And people say, oh, the system doesn't work. The system works exactly as it's designed to work. This is how it's supposed to work. Earl spends 34 years in prison, and he gets out, and he's $5,000 in debt. And he's 65 years old. He's worked every day of his life, 8 hours a day, for about 15 or 20 cents an hour. He's denied Social Security. I mean, they stack, you know, you can't get into public housing. You can't get food stamps. I mean, you see how these people come out. And in the case that I began this story with, on this particular guy who went to the system, they offered him 16 months. This was the plea deal. Take the 16 months. He went to court. They gave him 30 years. And as Earl said, you know, there's another student of mine went in at 14. It was a knifing. He was in a group. He says he didn't do it. I think he didn't do it. He's 14 years old. He's pulled all night in a police station in Camden. He's crying. They won't let any of his family members come in. It's like 2 in the morning. Just sign this. You can go home. He signs it. It's a confession. 14-year-old boy. They throw him in Camden County Jail up on the upper tier with all of the adult felons, where he sits until he's 16. He goes into the system. He's not eligible for parole until he's 70. Earl and I could sit here for this whole hour and tell you stories like
that. That's a Central Park jogger story. Yeah. Again, kids underage, yeah, all night in the police station, sign this, you go home,
yeah,
and where do they go?
But if you come, and Earl, I think, will second this, if you come out of places like Camden or Newark, you know, and then we haven't even begun the issue of police informants.
Yeah.
They have a whole list of people with petty charges that don't want to go back into the county, and they go say, look, you know, we've got this guy we want to put away. You know, it's like a stable, and the cops just bring him. It's a conveyor belt. They're just railroaded.
What's amazing about what you're saying is, I think your point, that it's a huge business that works.
Yeah.
And so here's Earl, who's earned probably hundreds of thousands of dollars for the people he's worked for, and walks out in debt, essentially. I mean, it's a real, real outrage. I think one thing we didn't mention, I just want to say it briefly, in your article, you talk about the number, which is 2.3 million people in U.S. prisons, and the statistic, which is 25% of the world's, of the population of, in prisons in the world,
yeah,
in a country that's less than 5% of the world's
absolutely
population. It's a staggering figure, and so you have to figure out what's going on here. Is our country just more dangerous and crime-ridden? Come on. No. It's about capitalism and making money, and I think, Chris, your point is very important.
Well, all totalitarian systems build and create forced labor. You know, that's what Stalin did to modernize Russia. That's what the fascists did. And our species of corporate totalitarianism is doing the same. It's the same model.
And there's a cruel irony in this. I'd like to mention that ALEC put forth what's called the Prison Industries Act, which changed the provision that inmates couldn't work for the private sector. And there's a thing called the PIA. It's an enhancement certification program. So under the guise of giving prisoners skills, marketable skills, it puts them back into the workforce for private industry. But as Earl mentioned, in fact, the opposite is happening. While they call it a skills enhancement program, they're not giving you the kind of skills that they used to, which is a travesty.
No, there's no skilled jobs for you to come out. I've seen it where you work on a job in prison where you can get a certificate stating that you are skilled. They would fire you on the job before you get the certificate. So you never got the certificate, and, you know, and you continue on working at these kind of jobs. And if you put up too much of a beef, you don't get a job at all. You just stay locked in your room all day, you know, and that's your punishment. You can't go to school. You can't do anything. You just stay. In fact, it's a program like that for young guys who's gang members. You can't get a job. You can't go to school. You can't do anything. Just stay in your room all day. You know, you can't do anything. Just stay in your room all day.
And we'll let Earl talk to this. But, you know, if you want to know what it's like to be in prison, go into your bathroom and lock the door and stay there for a weekend.
And think about this. I've stayed in a room like your toilet for years without coming out. They got a program in Trent called MCU. Management Control Unit, and they put you in there, and you can stay in there for years. I got friends who've been up there for 12, 14, 16 years and come out once a week to take a shower, and that's it.
You know, I'm not going to credit any system in the world of prisons, but when we're looking at solitary in the United States, of which there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people go through solitary, and you go to the United Kingdom, the number is 4 or 3 people altogether in a year that go into solitary. It's considered barbaric, essentially, in the rest of the world. And when Chris was mentioning plea deals, they wouldn't know what you were talking about in most of Europe. Doesn't happen.
Believe it or not, up until a few years, let's say maybe 15 years, there was no solitary confinement units or no ASSEG units in the state of New Jersey. Now you got them in every prison. You got whole units with all solitary confinement. It used to, like you were saying, they sent 1 or 2 people a year. That's the way it was in this state at one time. I can remember back in the early 80s, you could stab someone, and you would barely do 3 months in lockup, and you would be out because there was no place to put you to do those kind of things. And what they did, they built those kind of solitary confinement units all over the state. In every prison, they built them.
How do you cope? What do you do to keep from going crazy in solitary?
Well, solitary, you have to literally, you'd be surprised what the human mind can do. You have to literally take on that responsibility to survive in that system. You know, I always looked at it like this, and I don't know if my folk parents was born into slavery and died into slavery, never had a day of freedom in their lives. Surely I can give up a few years of my life because of what they went through, you know, so it don't bother me as much as it might bother some other people. I've stayed in lockup for years, you know, without coming out.
You know, Earl can talk to this. You get people who go into solitary like Audrey Latulo, mm-hmm. and every breath and act that they take is an act of resistance.
Yeah.
Audrey wouldn't wear, he'd go naked. I'm not wearing their uniform. And I think that ability, and I find it remarkable in people like Audrey or Earl, and I don't know how they do it, or Mumia. Well, I went up and saw Mumia.
Yeah.
That it is this power, spiritual power, really,
yeah.
to stand up. I mean, I remember, and Earl can talk about this, that, you know, some of my students were talking about how, you know, when you come into a prison, they teach you how to behave. Prisons are plantations, basically. Mm-hmm. They teach you how to behave to the boss man, which means keep your head down. And all of the prisoners in Trenton, it was just a small but extremely important act of resistance, said, we are not keeping our head down. We are keeping our heads up.
Yeah.
It's these kinds of acts. And people like Earl, who came in with a political sophistication, or like Audrey Latulo, who was 22 years in
isolation.
Because he was a member of the Black Liberation Army. No, that really wasn't why. It's because he's smart.
Mm-hmm.
And because they did not want people like Audrey or Earl talking to the other kids in there.
Right.
But I think that those acts of resistance, I'll see what you think. I think, you know, those little, they're not little, they're big, but from the outside they look little. I think they keep you alive, don't you think?
Yes, I do. I do believe that. When you can contribute something to a young person's life coming into prison, you know, it really says something about you as a human being. It tells the rest of the prison what kind of person you are. You know, I can remember Reuben Hurricane Carter went through the same thing. I can remember the kind of person he were. And I wanted to emulate Reuben because Reuben was like my hero, you know. And Reuben resisted everything. If you told, if the coffee was too black, Reuben wrote a writ of him.
I visited Reuben down in Trenton. And I remember him telling me this prison was built before the Civil War. Yes. The walls of this prison are 3.5 feet wide, and there's a Ku Klux Klanners running around this place. And I remember the dignity and the toughness that he had, right. And it was just was inspiration.
Right. Reuben was a very special guy, and I emulated Reuben my entire life because I know if Reuben resisted everything, and no matter what it was, if they wanted it done, Reuben did the other thing. You know, I mean, that's how Reuben survived all the years he spent in prison. So people wanted to stand up and be like Reuben because to be like Reuben what meant that you was a man because that's how you judge men's in prison.
Yeah, but he beat him back. I went and visited him. He got into minimum security after Trenton. Yeah. And I went to visit him there. He had his own cell. Yeah. And it was like an office. He had all the books he wanted. Yeah. He had a typewriter. Right. He had his own clothes. He wore civilian clothes. Right. He was on the phone talking about getting out of there.
Right.
So after all those years, he beat him back.
Yeah, Ruby was that kind of a guy.
I really want to thank you, Chris, Earl, Amos. It's an extraordinary hour, and I think you've really opened up on the world an issue that you know is incredibly, makes me incredibly angry and is an outrage. And Earl, to see you after 35 years, the way you are is incredibly moving, I think, for all of us, and really a big hug of solidarity and support. It's been quite wonderful to see you.
Thank you, and I really appreciate being here. You got some great people here who are trying to do some things to help those people in prison, and I appreciate it, and I want to contribute wherever I can.
Chris Hedges, Earl Ammon, and Amos Cayley.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.